Welcome to the History of Little Europe, episode 1.21, time to get controversial. Last time, we covered the Swiss military World War II experience, as the state fought itself to keep itself afloat in a sea of red. In this episode, we will cover the home front of the war, as well as Switzerland's emergence into a post-war Europe as a new world order dawns. If you will recall from the last episode, Switzerland's military strategy revolved in large part around making sure the nation was never attacked. The success of such a plan, though, resulted in a domestic front which could operate in much the same way it had during the interwar years. And those years were not exactly without turmoil. On both sides of the political spectrum, radical parties rose up in their own attempts to establish control over the state. And, given the state of Europe, it wasn't exactly hard to picture circumstances in which either end might have seized control. To begin, let's talk about the fascist movements. If you will recall from our discussion of the interwar years, there was already something of a thriving fascist movement in Switzerland. It was by no means massive, but it was well established and well known. Fascism, in particular, rapidly grew in popularity over the first half of the year, especially after the surrender of France. Many in Switzerland assumed that they were witnessing the dawning of a new world order and began agitating for change. In September of 1940, the then president of the Confederation, Marcel Pilet-Golat, gave a speech hitting at the need for internal restructuring more in line with their new neighbors, and several others within the political sphere came forward to express their interest in at least hearing the fascists out. Over the next few months, support for these movements continued to grow until, in December of that year, the state issued a decree banning all political parties which based their ideologies on what it declared extreme. And I want to pause here for a minute because that bears repeating. The Swiss state banned political parties which it believed to be dangerous or harmful to the well-being of the state based on their ideology. This is no small thing. This is the state actively curtailing political freedom for what it believes to be beneficial. Of course, it also worked, so maybe it doesn't bear worrying too much about. The other thing worth mentioning is that, while this ban most directly curtailed fascist and far-right movements, the law also banned communist parties. Given that there were currently members of the federal government who had been elected due to their membership in communist parties, this didn't go over too well. And speaking of communists, Switzerland is rapidly approaching the high watermark of the movement. As the war progressed, the large number of men committed to the borders gave the workers in factories more leverage than they had previously possessed, and they decided the time was right to strike. As the war progressed, curtailments against radical parties were slowly lifted, until, by 1942, the Swiss communists were free to operate essentially as they pleased, as long as they ditched the communist branding. This would culminate in 1943, when the SP, the Swiss Socialist Party, won the largest number of seats in Parliament, and even managed to place one of their own on the Federal Council. Who, you may ask? Why, it's Ernest Nobbs from a few episodes ago. He's still kicking around. With this new domineering position in Swiss politics, the SP could get back to their demands from the strikes of 1918, because even if you forgot them, they sure as hell haven't. In this case, that meant the introduction of state-provided old age and survivors insurance, the latter more crucial than ever, as war could at any moment break out. But even with their momentum, they would be unable to push the ticket further, and over the course of the coming years, the SP would see themselves transform from commanders of a new Switzerland into one of the pillars of a stable coalition that would last the 20th century. But that is a story for another time. If anything else, this era is just one in a long list of Swiss anachronisms. As the rest of Europe fell to various forms of radical political beliefs, Switzerland walked the narrow line between them and came out the other side all the better for it. I'll discuss this a bit more in our wrap-up episode, but this balancing act seems to be one of the things most attributable to the relative success of the Swiss state. But, other than domestic politics, Switzerland had to worry about their new economic situation. Because then, as now, Switzerland was naturally economically centered around imports and exports to Germany. But we're right back to that fine line, because get too cozy with the Germans and the Allies start breathing down your neck. Well, trying to only trade with the Allies would prove at best difficult given the relative location, and at worst catastrophic if Germany got rubbed the wrong way. Thus, it proved necessary that, despite the impressions the Swiss military was trying to give off, the Swiss state needed to maintain at least cordial relations with its neighbors. The popular rendition of World War II has Switzerland hiding away in a bunker. It's often forgotten that they maintained fairly active diplomatic connections to Germany. Over the course of the war, Switzerland continued to export as much as 60% of its manufactured tools, machines, and arms to Germany, in exchange for raw materials like iron and coal. The trade was going so strong that Germany was actually running a deficit throughout much of the war, with Switzerland amassing hundreds of millions in German governmental debt. On the flip side, the Germans traded precious metals and gold, frequently stolen, for Swiss francs, which could be used to purchase international goods. But, of course, if you go too far in one direction, the other side starts to flare up. The Allies numerously accused Switzerland of aiding the German war effort and continually pressured it to cut back on its trade with Germany. Switzerland dragged its feet throughout the process, but as the war was beginning to wind to a close, Switzerland accepted an agreement ending trade with Germany, especially as the liberation of France opened up new trading opportunities. Another result of this trade predicament was the establishment of the Swiss Navy. Today, Switzerland operates the strongest naval force of any landlocked nation, which, I'm told, is a distinction actually worth making. But, far from what impressions you might have of such an institution, the group was, and is, mostly focused on defending trade and merchant vessels along the Rhine River based out of Basel. Above all, the decision to create a Swiss Navy was predicated on the necessity to fly a flag that would, at least on paper, prevent it from being mistaken for a combatant vessel. But now, it is time that we must turn to more uncomfortable topics. After the conclusion of the war, Switzerland would come under ever-increasing criticism and controversy for some of its actions, especially in relation to stolen goods and the Jewish community. As we proceed forward, it is important to note, at the outset, that while many of the facts and numbers are disputed, nobody on either side of the debate is outright denying that any of the events about to be discussed actually occurred. In 1995, the United States, in conjunction with the World Jewish Conference, issued harsh criticism against Switzerland in relationship to the following wartime activities: receiving gold plundered by the Nazis, possessing and maintaining large sums of money and valuables deposited by soon-to-be victims of the Holocaust, turning tens of thousands of Jews away at the border, despite at the time being aware of Nazi activities, and prolonging the war by maintaining trade with the Axis. In 1996, Switzerland began work on what would become known as the Bergier Report, which, despite government connections, would come down decidedly against the actions of the Swiss state. They found that Switzerland accepted 60,000 civilian refugees during the war, roughly half of which were Jewish, and 20,000 were turned back, almost all of which were Jewish. They found that the state had prolonged the war by continuing its trade, and that as many as 10,000 German political prisoners were forced to work in German branches of Swiss companies, the majority under Nestle, who received inadequate quartering during their time. And now I reach that time where I start talking about recent events. While I try my best to remain neutral in the production of this podcast, I must outline that at this stage, I believe there is overwhelming evidence in favor of one side. In 1997, Christoph Miele, a night watchman at UBS in Zurich, discovered that thousands of documents pertaining to the dormant accounts of Holocaust victims were being destroyed by the company. Although the public was overwhelmingly in support of his actions, he was in violation of the Swiss bank secrecy law and had to seek political asylum in the United States. While he has since returned to Switzerland, the state has never confirmed nor denied that the actions he witnessed took place. Instead, under the threat of boycott, in 1998, Swiss banks agreed to pay out $1.25 billion to various claimants. We may never know the full extent, but by some estimates, this is still less than 10% of the total amounts still found in dormant accounts. But I don't want to just end the episode there, so I'd like to leave it off with a couple of stories that I found interesting. The first is that of Paul Gruninger. Paul Gruninger was the police commander of the canton of St. Gallen. Following the annexation of Austria by the Third Reich, Switzerland had closed its border to Jewish people arriving without proper entry permits. And in October of 1938, negotiations between Switzerland and the Third Reich led to the stamping of the infamous J in passports issued to Jewish people. As the situation worsened, and the number of refugees who tried to illegally enter Switzerland to be secure from the Holocaust increased, the then 47-year-old Swiss official decided in summer of 1938 not to send back the refugees to their country. Instead, facing the consequences of breaking the explicit instructions of his government. Moreover, in order to legalize the refugees' status, he falsified the refugees' visas so that their passports showed that they had arrived in Switzerland before March 1938, when immigration to Switzerland had been restricted. The manipulations of dates enabled the newly arrived Jewish refugees to be treated as legals, and they had to be taken to the Diepoldzell camp. There, aided by Jewish organizations, the refugees awaited their permits for temporary stay in Switzerland, or their final departure to a final destination. Gruninger turned in false reports about the number of arrivals and the status of the refugees in his district, and impeded efforts to trace refugees who were known to have entered Switzerland illegally. The German authorities informed the Swiss authorities of Gruninger's exploits, and he was dismissed from the police force in March of 1939. The second story is that of Karl Lutz. Appointed in 1942 as Swiss Vice Consul in Budapest, Lutz soon began cooperating with the Jewish Agency for Israel. He issued Swiss safe conduct documents that enabled almost 10,000 Hungarian Jewish children to emigrate, and saved over 62,000 Jews by some estimates. Lutz negotiated a special deal with the Hungarian government and the Nazis. He gained permission to issue protective letters to 8,000 Hungarian Jews for emigration to Palestine. Lutz deliberately used his permission for 8,000 as applying to families rather than individuals, and proceeded to issue tens of thousands of additional protective letters, all of them bearing a number between 1 and 8,000. He also set up some 76 safe houses around Budapest, declaring them annexes of the Swiss legation and thus off-limits to Hungarian forces or Nazi soldiers. Among the safe houses was the now well-known Glass House at Vadatz Street 29. About 3,000 Hungarian Jews found refuge at the Glass House and in a neighboring building over the course of the war. One day, in front of the fascist Arrow Cross Party militiamen, Lutz jumped into the Danube River to save a bleeding Jewish woman along the dock. Dressed in a now soaking full suit, the consul swam back to the bank with her and asked to speak with a Hungarian officer in charge of the firing squad. Declaring the wounded woman a foreign citizen protected by Switzerland, and quoting international covenants, the Swiss consul brought her back to his car in front of the stunned fascists and left quietly. After the conclusion of the war, Lutz would live out the rest of his days peacefully. Several memorials to him can be found both in Budapest and in Israel. Join us next time for the grand finale to our Switzerland series, where we rip through the remainder of Swiss history, and I give some rather pretentious concluding remarks. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at History of Little Europe, and until next time, was like Nanya, ciao, and goodbye.